Humans on the Run is an attempt to preserve memories of several microscopic journeys embarked upon by humans, often in conditions of utter and complete hopelessness. A collection of 24 stories that narrate first-person accounts of migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers affected by multiple displacements due to political or sectarian strife across several countries: India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Eritrea, Ukraine, and South Sudan. Here to tell us more about it live on the line is author of Humans on the Run, Kumar Tiku. Kumar, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Giles, and good morning to the listeners of Talk Radio Europe.
Good to have you with us. Whereabouts do we find you today? Whereabouts are you calling in from today?
I'm about 30 miles east of New Delhi, India.
So tell me a little bit about your particular story and how it affected you and why this led to the book Humans on the Run.
Okay, so Giles, thanks again for that short introduction about this book. And I mean, conflicts have been with us as a staple of hourly news for some time on print and on air and online, what have you. Television news particularly thrives on pictures of, you know, barrel bombs and raining missiles and war zones and so on. And I think in all of this, we do definitely see that the coverage that the humanitarian crisis that these wars have engendered doesn't really get its fair share of coverage. In 2015, when I first felt the itch, as it were, to make sense of conflict-scarred lives lived in perpetual homelessness, I had in my sights my own experience as an unrecognized displaced Kashmiri person in India. And I was working for UNICEF in Syria at that time. My work as a humanitarian aid worker with UNICEF and the UN Development Program, as a matter of fact, had taken me to multiple conflict hotspots, stretching from Afghanistan to Syria, and from Iraq to South Sudan, giving me countless opportunities to directly interact with people whose lives have been upended by politics, as we know, and in the name of religion and sect and ethnicity and what have you. At a very personal level as well, Giles, for over 28 years now, I have been a participant and an observer, as it were, in this whole drama of homelessness and displacement. That's because in 1989, I stepped out of my own rather cocooned small-town life in Srinagar, that is the capital of the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir. And at that time, it seemed reasonable for me to hope that I would return home one day after setting my career on a course, you know, as a professional journalist in the nearest big city, which was New Delhi. Alas, that was not to be, because violence besieged my city just months after I stepped out in 1989. That extremist violence, coupled with frenzied and very provocative threats by armed insurgent groups in Kashmir, targeted my minority Hindu community and led to a wholesale flight of almost 500,000 strong terror-stricken people and the ethnic group that I belong to. And well, a full 28 years later, there's still no sign there that I could ever go back. Therefore, I relate very, very directly with the pain of homeless millions who are, today scattered practically everywhere on the globe. And I guess that forms my entry point into the subject of, looking at the lives of people in displacement.
Just going back to your own story, I mean, when you stepped out, you said 28 years ago, and you stepped out of your front door and went to New Delhi. Did you have any inkling that this situation was brewing that would mean that you would never be able up to this point, you have been unable to return to Kashmir?
Interesting. Actually, to say that, there was this eerie sense that something is going to implode in our faces. But, you know, it's like rape or anything else, unless it actually happens, you're never prepared for it. There were straws in the wind and signs in the air that the minority Hindu community in Kashmir might be targeted. Mind you, the conflict in Kashmir was very political in nature, but it very, very quickly became a communal conflict. To be utterly honest, I mean, one didn't see it coming in quite the way that it did. There were signs, and there was intimidation, and there was this sense of something is going to happen. But we didn't really know that we would be rendered homeless for a very long time.
So you've been working with UNICEF during that period. Is there a familiar thread there that you've got, a common thread that you've found when you're dealing with people who have been forced to move? Is there a common thread?
And that's precisely it's a very interesting question, and that's precisely the way I looked at this whole story, because living in different countries that were sometimes geographically very, very apart, I did realize the names changed, the socioeconomic demography changed, the religions of people who were rendered homeless by this crisis changed. But in terms of its actual impact and the overall very corrosive kind of dehumanization that inevitably sets in as you get into chronic displacement, those trends and insights were extremely secular. My professional journey with the UN took me first to Afghanistan, where I spent just under 5 years, for a majority of the time listening to a myriad broken men and women who had lived to tell the stories of their own shattered and scattered lives. And then I went to South Sudan, thereon to Syria, and even in Iraq, where one doesn't see a whole lot of, not in the same proportion, the external displacement, but a lot of internal displacement in that country. But Syria, that experience really took the biscuit and the bakery, as it were. I'd never, ever prepared myself to see something as dehumanizing as the condition that I came face to face with. For 15 months I traveled there, across the length and breadth of that country, trying to deliver humanitarian aid, the basic stuff, portable drinking water and vaccination kits and school bags and textbooks and so on, and just seeing how many men, women and children really were held in siege as literally human shields by the opposing parties to the conflict. Across Damascus, Homs, Hama, Aleppo, it was the same story of, once very neat and orderly cities that had been visited by wars and bombs, and now resembled vast ruins with human beings literally feeling like ruins and of their former selves. So, countless mothers and children living in utter destitution, abandoned in unfinished buildings, inexplicable conditions, trying to soothe the frayed nerves of their little children and trying to stay sane in the face of that relentless barrel bomb bombardment, and of course getting used to a life of perpetual displacement from one neighborhood to the next, and often from even one city to the next, and in many cases moving from country to country as well. And there were stories that really got to me, some more than others, and I pursued those stories to the very end and tailed those characters like a shadow. And and in Afghanistan it was the same, and I was trying to observe and process changes in their lives, including their own psychological lives, and trying to see how people were making use of the last vestiges of their resilience and surviving as perpetual journeymen.
I mean, there's a thought here, because here we are. I'm speaking to you two from a studio in southern Spain in Europe, and we have been bombarded with images from Syria, images of refugees from Afghanistan, Pakistan. The media reports, certain sections of the English media report on the migrants trying to get from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from Syria, trying to get across the channel, etc. And we know about the reports that we had coming out of Germany as well, with their open door program with migrants, with the problems with Hungary, for example, putting up walls. Is there a problem that perhaps that we sitting here comfortably in our seats in Europe can't grasp the vastness of the situation that is happening in a country that was like Syria, and like several others of them that you report on, that were to all intents and purposes civilized countries up until less than a decade ago?
Yeah, Giles, I mean, It's very true that the Central Mediterranean route has become a massive people smuggling operation, and it's grown out of all control in the absence of really alternative migration systems. It exploits porous and corrupt border security, the sparse Saharan terrain, and the vacuum that's created essentially in Libya, for example. But having said that, my own feeling as an extremely small reporter, if you were, of the human condition, is that the European response in the main has lacked coherence, to say the least. Tough prevailing economic conditions in several parts of Europe have only served to further fan the gusts of suspicion and xenophobia, if you allow me to say that. And the fact is, nation after nation has locked down its borders and crammed refugees into transit camps in horrible living conditions. And some have literally expressed open reluctance to taking in Muslims, for example, who also by far, form by far the largest religious group of asylum seekers. But I think what is forgotten in all of this is that the vast majority of the world's refugees are still not in Europe. I mean, Europe has probably 1/50th of of the refugee burden of the world. And I mean, one statistics, and I don't want to bore you with numbers, but I was reading somewhere that 86% of the refugees under the mandate of the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, back in 2015, when I was doing research for this book, almost 86% of the people were in low and middle income countries, close to the situations of conflict. Ethiopia, for example, is a prime example of a third world country accounting for a vast majority of refugees from a whole gaggle of countries in Africa, stretching from South Sudan, Eritrea, Yemen, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and so on. Take Syria, for example, and almost 5 million have fled to Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, which is now the place where the maximum refugees in the world are located. It's such a tiny little thing, and even Egypt and I mentioned Lebanon, all these countries between them are hosting close to 7 million, just from one country, that's serious. So, and we're not even talking about, the headcount of the internally displaced within these conflict-affected countries, which is way more than those who become officially refugees and so on. So I think basically, it's true on the one side, that there is, Europe has a problem on its hand, but I think it's also our inability to learn from history that's condemning us, as it were, to repeat the same mistakes. Europe actually is the architect of the 1951 Refugee Convention, which is the world's most enabling international instrument to hand out, a sane and solid kind of a refugee status to people around the world. So that's it. And imagine the conditions in which these hapless people lunge for the sea to take these boats to a place of relative safety and some welfare as well. It's a very, very tough choice, but I think a historical perspective is absolutely important. Despite the ripples that can be seen in Europe and even North America, the world does not see the end of civil and political conflicts. We have to do something at the source first, get rid of these conflicts, because conflicts ride on the back of the divisions and schisms of religion within their own within these fragile contexts, and then we have this massive issue, a massive humanitarian tragedy on our hands. It's difficult, but I think there is an absolute need to rethink this whole problem, because we are face to face with literally a lost generation of children who are now getting used to such a vagrant, helpless life that make no mistake, you know, this could be the cannon fodder for the jihad of tomorrow.
Let's get away from the vast sweep of history and the vast sweep of millions of people. You've, in your book, have put this down to taking a microscopic view. You've looked at 24 stories. How did you pick out those 24 stories and tell us a little bit about some of the people that you walked with on their journey?
Yeah, literally, you know, in I looked at the number 25 was important to me because I started work on this book project in 2015, which was the 25th year of my own migration from Kashmir, that had happened in 1989-90. And I found myself wholly ill-equipped to write only on Kashmir and what happened with that. And also the fact that, you know, there is no dearth of intellectual tomes on every conflict that takes place in the world. I was very, very focused on bringing a human face to the disasters and the dehumanizing experiences of conflicts on ordinary humans who often have absolutely nothing to do with those conflicts. So, and then, you know, as luck would have it, as my destiny would have it, from 2007 onwards, I lived consistently in conflict hotspots of the world, as I said, and my work itself as a frontline aid worker, you know, brought me face to face with many characters, and I'd kept copious notes from many of my you know, assignments and travels on the front lines and so on, and then at that time it wasn't very clear to me, you know, that I would make sense of it in terms of documentation of homelessness and so on, but being a communications professional, I had very often to tell those stories of the situation on the ground in these far out places, and more than what the UN was bringing it for me, what was very, very important was to be the first line respondent reporter of the human condition in those places. And very often we neglect that because, you know, we sometimes as aid workers have more access to those frontline locations than even media and journalists, you know, who have to operate under a very strict security regimes and so on often. So I had those notes, initially all stacked up for facilitating future stories by journalists that I was, in touch with at that time in various assignments. And then there were very clear characters whose stories were, you know, just to mention one person whom I met back in 2007 in Kabul, and she was this Pashtun woman, extremely traditional, and she came to me initially as a journalist, then went on to work with me as a national communications professional, and very soon I came face to face with her own story. I mean, at 24 she had already a couple of children, and a marriage that had been consummated in a refugee camp in Peshawar, and then she had moved back to Kabul only to feel the heat again because there was just so much uncertainty and violence, and looking at her own two kids, she was totally unsure about, you know, how this is going to shape up for them. And so, you know, every sinew of her body was focused on trying to get out of Afghanistan to a quote-unquote safer place. Her couple of elder sisters had already made those perilous journeys. And then finally, you know, in 2015, after I think almost 7 or 8 years of paying off middlemen and agents and this, that, and the other, she finds herself in Austria. And I meet her in a small place outside Vienna called Eisenstadt. And when I saw her, she was almost 1 year into living in that place. And I could tell that she was finally picking the pieces, and that focus of her life, which was to give a slightly safer, saner future for the children, was close to being met, and she was feeling a relative normality in her life. And characters like that, I bumped into several places. I mean, in my postings and assignments, but also during my travels, and those are the centerpiece of this book.
What do you think we can learn then? What do you hope people will take from Humans on the Run? And what do you think we can do to make, I don't know, not the refugee experience easier, but do you think there's something that we can take positive from your report, from the 24 stories?
Well, there's a lot of resilience. I mean, that is for sure. I think taken together, when you read the stories of the book, and you'll realize, you know, how much we bicker. I mean, as perfectly normal middle class people, you know, given to status quo and all the comforts of our life. But there's a lot to learn from these lives in terms of, you know, how much resilience human beings are capable of. And so to me, that to me has been personally a tremendously elevating and edifying experience. I mean, I wish, and also the fact that, you know, somebody needs to listen. I mean, there is a, I'm no great political analyst or whatever, Jais, I'm just an air humanitarian worker. But I think humanitarian agencies have been crying hoarse, trying to wake up the conscience of states and people and citizens to rise as one man, as it were, against the futility of war and conflicts. Because in the end, we'll all pay, and we're all in it together. So I think those voices need to be heeded, and we need to call a stop to violence and conflict, because it is ultimately in nobody's interest.
The book is called Humans on the Run: Of Exiles and Asylums. It's out now on Oxford University Press. It's by Kuma Mtiku. Kuma, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, do you have a website? Is there social media where people can find you?
Yes, I'm on Facebook, as every other citizen on this planet, and I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Super. So that's Kuma. It's Kuma MTQ on Facebook and the social media. I mean, you talked about scattered and shattered lives and a hope to return home. Do you hope there's one day you'll be able to return to your own homeland?
That's a fond hope. It never leaves me. And I've dwelt at that hope in great length in the book. And I do hope that day will come one day.
Well, we hope it comes one day and one day soon. Kuma Tiku, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you very much, Giles. And thank you for having me on your program.